you a high performer, obsessed with growth, and looking for an edge? Welcome to Mind Body Peak Performance. Together, we'll discover underground secrets to unlocking the full potential of your mind, body, and spirit. We'll learn from some of the world's leading minds, from ancient wisdom to cutting-edge tools and everything in between. This is your host, Nick Urban. Enjoy the episode. What if some of the most incredible health transformation tools are actually staring us right in the face, and they've been around for years, decades, or in some cases, even centuries, yet for some reason have largely been forgotten today? Welcome to Mind Body Peak Performance. I'm your host, Nick Urban, and today that is exactly what we are discussing. Our guest this week is Phil Mikins. Phil has been dedicated to anti-aging, preventative, and regenerative medicine for more than 30 years. He helps spread the latest international lifespan information to the public by being editor to the Aging Matters magazine. Plus, he assists with many other publications and conferences. He also established the IAS Group, which is an organization dedicated to finding hard-to-obtain supplements and health products, some of which we discuss today. In this episode, you'll learn why so much of the world's health information is not indexed and easily accessible via PubMed, and worst of all, a lot of what we used to know has been forgotten. If you have interest in either aging, the visual system, the auditory system, or skin, this episode will be jam-packed with information. If you want to find the previous episode Phil and I recorded together, that will be at mindbodypeak.com/106. And then this one will be at mindbodypeak.com/123. That's where you'll find all the resources and things we discuss if you want to check them out for yourself. And speaking of, if you want to go ahead and grab yourself some of the peptide bioregulators, I would suggest going back to that previous show. And if you use the code URBAN in the Profound Health shop, that'll save you on your order. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, Phil Mikins. Phil Mikins, welcome back to Mind Body Peak Performance.
Thanks, Nick. Great pleasure to be here again.
Yeah, we recorded an episode together. I think it was number 106, and that was a big hit. We talked about peptide bioregulators. We will reference that again in this show. But there are a lot of things we've discussed, just you and I, offline when the cameras were not rolling, and a lot of really cool stuff that I'm going to guess most people have never heard of. And will you share how that is possible, that there's such cool things out there? Such cool inventions and medical health interventions. And how can these work if no one's heard of them?
Right, right. Well, the bottom line is some people have heard of them. Some countries have approved them. But if you talk about mass knowledge, like the world knows Viagra or Prozac or something like that, no, they're nowhere near that level. And we can certainly get into some of the reasons why. In fact, I think all the things I want to mention today are effectively natural agents. And that's one of the major stumbling blocks to getting anything promoted. And unfortunately, whether we like it or not, with the systems that are practiced in the Western countries like yours and mine, they need that promotion, you know. There are not many doctors, practicing doctors, medical doctors, what we call GPs in the UK, general practitioners, who have enough time to look up the research and all the rest. So let's be honest, most of them might go along to a few medical conferences sponsored probably by pharmaceutical companies and then wait for the pharmaceutical reps to come in and tell them what's new. So how can we put it? That makes the world rather tainted and rather slanted into one direction. Meanwhile, there can be the most wonderful research that's been done in different places, some of it being decades old, many decades old. And when you hear about what it works, how it works, And you'd be flabbergasted in some cases in the medical journals it's appeared in, right, serious ones, or indeed the number of patients who've actually used it and it's being recorded. So on that basis, you'd think, oh, why aren't they using them? But there are all kinds of commercial pressures, which we can get into.
Are there any in particular that you like to start out with?
Sure, absolutely. From one perspective, I'm looking at this. They reckon that presently online, there, and I'm just talking medicine here, I'm not talking general health, general nutrition, or clinical and personal experiences, of which there'd be far, far more. But in the medical literature, it's estimated that today 50 million publications, 50 million articles are online. 1 million are added every year. Okay, that's the present level. But probably somewhere between 15 and 20% is online. The rest is in the libraries of the world. And of course, that can also mean it's different languages. You know, it's not all going to be English. It could be Chinese, could be Russian, you know, who knows? Any number of languages. So if we start thinking about an individual or even a group of individuals who are going to go off and find this plethora of information, it soon becomes apparent that with trying to go through the libraries of the world, even trying to do what's online, and then having a knowledge of what might be 20 different languages or more is impossible. There's no group of individuals who can do it. So suddenly, because well, if we had AI, and if it was able to go and read everything that's already been published, and then come back to us with a, so you type in your problem. So let's say you type in prostate cancer, just as an example. If AI could go away and read all that massive literature and come back and say, well, I found this, this, and this that could best suit your needs, suddenly you could have the most amazing focus. And to use a line that I'm rather proud of, because I'm writing an article on this, it's imagine if we did that, we'd actually learn what we've already discovered. Okay. And that, I think, is a big problem, because it's fantastic that new research is going on and looking for things. But on several occasions in my life, I've heard, you know, researchers, quite well-known people actually, say we're looking for this and we're looking for that. And I'll say, oh, it's already been done. Haven't you seen this? Haven't you seen that? And they're always a bit gobsmacked. There is one example I can give here, which is a bit of, because what today is about either saying wow or being shocked. A man I have great respect for, Dr. Jonathan Wright. He runs a clinic in Tahoma in Washington. Very big clinic, has lots of people underneath him. He actually found a combination of things, which I'll also come to separately, that reversed macular degeneration in people's eyes. And it's a combination of basically minerals and melatonin as well. At one point, and I'm going back quite a few years here, probably even a decade, maybe more now, he actually advertised, I will, you know, come to my clinic and I will reverse your wet or dry, and I'll get into why that's important, macular degeneration, or I'll give you your money back. Now, that's not a phrase you hear a lot in doctors' offices and clinics, is it? And you can imagine the interest, but the FDA prevented it. They went to him and they said, you can't do this. You cannot give a money back guarantee. And he said, why? And they told him it was unfair to the doctors who couldn't. So I'm not making this up, folks. So can you imagine? Can you imagine any other industry where something like that could take place? And they say, this is your health. This is not getting quite the right tire on your car, right? Well, I really wanted the Michelin. They only gave me the Dunlop. This is not quite like that, is it? I would say it's a bit more important.
Yeah. When I was writing a simple article on like the basics of peptide bioregulators, I read two books on it. I looked through PubMed. I looked through other sites that had research, and a lot of it was in Russian. Then I discovered there was an argument over whether or not they translated the dosages properly when they were translating the language. And there's like so many different areas where someone who doesn't understand all of the nuances of it, like pretty much everyone out there, because there's so much and it's not all in native language and information is scattered. It's so difficult to get like a simple, concise answer. So this is somewhere that AI could really help, and there wouldn't be as much stuff lost in translation, and it would all be in one central place rather than 100 different areas around the internet.
And as you correctly say, there are nuances within languages that don't translate well into our native languages. And just from an English perspective, trying to teach a foreigner the difference between could, would, should. For example, the word nootropics, which I think a lot of people are aware of, which generally speaking means towards the mind, if you like direct translations. But my good friend Marius Kroazis, who's a doctor and has written various books, including perhaps one of the peptide books that you read, he was saying it's like saying the wood, you know, the tree and the woods at the same time. So it's very difficult to translate into English, but obviously makes sense in Greek.
Yeah. And to learn more about our episode on peptide bioregulators, how those work, what makes them so special, you can check out the show notes at mindbodypeak.com/106, which was the number of the episode. There was a lot there, a lot of questions, and a lot of promise behind those. Can you give a quick summary of what peptide bioregulators are?
Indeed, Nick. And I would say this is one of the wow factors. The Soviets, because it was in that time, discovered that short chain peptides, so what do I mean by that? These are very small links of amino acids. A peptide is made up of amino acids, and a bioregulator, which is a term that's been given by Professor Vladimir Kavinson, who's the lead researcher behind all of this. And they are basically peptides made up of 2, 3, or 4 amino acids. So they're particularly small, but they're not all bioregulators. So what they discovered was that these, and they discovered, well, commercially available today, there are 21. Although actually, if you look at the literature, it was probably approaching 50 that they discovered in the literature, are in different foods. Okay. And they are gene switches. So if you stop and think about that for a moment, it's a hidden message within food. Everybody knows we are what you are what you eat. Everybody knows that expression. Everybody is getting into epigenetics, you know, how food changes us. And biohacking, of course, is a big part of that. Imagine if you knew which peptides, which food groups to silence or activate a specific gene for a specific purpose. Okay. And you're really getting into what's called precision medicine, very much precision medicine. And the Russians and the Soviets, originally it was a Soviet military secret. They reserved it for their troops, their cosmonauts, and their Olympic teams. But since Perestroika, this stuff has been in the open. And today, the oral versions, and they work orally. Anybody that knows about peptides knows that most of them don't work well orally because their chains are too long. But these ones work orally, and with all the evidence, all the backup. They're food supplements in the Russian countries. It's not just Russia. You know, it is Ukraine and Kazakhstan and Georgia and Azerbaijan and other countries in that region. So, so they're sold as food supplements. They're incredibly safe. There are various, it's a long list, 21, but you've got things like heart and liver and kidney and pineal and testes and ovaries. You know, there's a lot there that people, if they're interested, go to our last time we spoke and look that up. So the implications of them are enormous.
Yeah. And what really stands out about them to me is they work epigenetically, so they don't actually change your genes, but they change the expression of your genes. They're also very safe. They're orally bioavailable, and they're naturally contained in small quantities within food. So it's like we're already consuming these, but like not enough to have the full therapeutic benefit that you want if you're, say, targeting your liver or your heart or your kidneys or your reproductive system.
That's absolutely right. And the incredible thing that most people can't get their heads around, and I don't think actually the science has been completely resolved on this, is the word bioregulator. Because what the same peptide can do with that specific gene is activate it or silence it. So, for example, let's take the thyroid gland in the neck. A lot of people, they have a weak thyroid. They're not producing enough thyroid hormones. I'll talk about adults. And they're hypothyroid. They're too little. If you take the thyroid peptide, it will actually, through the gene, encourage the thyroid. You do need the thyroid, of course. Persons who've had it removed don't work, right? Don't do nothing. But let's say you have got the thyroid, it will activate them to make more thyroid hormones. So this is really fundamental. It's endogenous. In other words, it's happening inside the body. It's not you taking a thyroid hormone, okay, which would be exogenous, outside the body. But here's the crazy thing. If you were one of the rarer persons who is producing too much thyroid hormones, i.e. your hyperthyroid, it will silence the gene and you'll stop manufacturing as much thyroid hormones. And it bioregulates. Think of it like an adaptogen. I think a lot of people are familiar with that term these days. So it's like an adaptogen. And it may also help to explain why in Russia, and Professor Cabinson has spoken of this openly, saying it's been dosed over 100 million times in millions of people. Because remember, folks, this has been happening over 40 years, right? This wasn't discovered last week. They haven't seen any serious side effects. And it could help to explain that you don't appear to be able to overdose.
And I think that normal peptides tend to be among the safer class of therapeutics, but then bioregulators are even a notch above that.
There's a lot of peptides out there. Hell of a lot. I mean, you know, when you think about it, you've got your amino acids. And then, of course, depending on where they are in the chain and how long the chain is, you know, you start going up, you start calling them. There are all sorts of, I did look up the other day, the longest peptide. I can't remember. I think it was around 50 amino acids. It's quite long. But we start calling them proteins. We even start calling them hormones, right? So take another example, human growth hormone. If memory serves me correctly, is 191 amino acids. So hell of a long one. You'd never be able to swallow it. It wouldn't work. It would never get through the stomach. That's why it has to be injected.
And I think a natural source of some of these bioregulators, again, in much smaller doses than if you took a dedicated supplement, would be in the respective organ. So say if I ate liver, then I'd be getting a small dose of the liver bioregulator in some form.
Absolutely. It goes back even to the work of people like Weston Price, who, if I remember rightly, you're talking like 20s, 30s, 40s, who made discoveries in native tribes around the world, some of which aren't there anymore, and saying that, you know, I remember one in particular, if memory serves me right, it was the Hunza tribe in Pakistan. I might be wrong, but I think it was. And they ate the necks of the animals. In fact, our forebears would have wasted nothing. You know, maybe mum or grandma, you know, made chicken soup from the bones. You'd had the meat, and of course, it wasn't that long ago when people ate the organ meats. And now we're so fussy, we don't want the black meat of a chicken. We only want the white meat. And then we only want the breast, maybe, you know, I don't know. So, but in days not so long ago, the entire animal was consumed. And Weston Price, in his studies, showed that the tribes who are eating, in this case, the necks of animals, didn't have any thyroid problems. And it could well be the peptides in those meats through gene switches that is responsible, you know. Just as a side note, one of the most respected thyroid medications is what's called desiccated thyroid, which comes from a pig. So when you consume a pig, porcine, to give it the right name, thyroid, you're getting a cross-reference of those. You might be getting the right balance. And I always thought that when I heard patients say, oh, I'm doing so much better now that I'm using these natural thyroids, I always thought that was the only reason. And a few years ago, I discovered that the porcine thyroid is bioidentical to human. That doesn't happen very often in the animal world, but it is. So there's a double whammy, you know. So that really explains it. But I think now with this new information, the world's moved on the next step, which is in understanding the foods, the peptides, and the genes.
Well, let's talk more about the visual system now, because you briefly mentioned to me about some of these cool products and the information behind them, but I'm still mostly in the dark around these. So I'm interested to hear what they are, how they work, and if there is any research or anecdotes that you've heard about each of them.
So I guess stick to the visuals. I've got two visuals to talk about today. I'll mention the one first that I've already alluded to, which is for macular degeneration. And in case folks don't know, macular degeneration is basically a breakdown on the retina in the eye, the back of the eye. And there are two forms. One is called dry, which is much more prevalent. Probably 80% of the people, maybe more, who have macular degeneration are dry. And generally it starts dry, which kind of means it's not bleeding. Literally, it's dry. And then you get wet, where is a bigger problem. And the situation in most countries is so bad that if you go along to the doc, and what happens is literally part of your vision will evaporate. You know, if you put a pencil in front of your eye, can you imagine if you moved around that bit you couldn't see? And it couldn't get worse. It depends where on the retina, it depends on the size, but generally it gets worse until eventually you might not see anything at all. So, you know, it's extremely concerning, obviously. Generally, most people, it starts off dry, and it can be dry for quite a long time. The drugs that are available are so expensive, so difficult to administer, they are injected into the eyeball. And that can be done like every 2 or 3 months, and so expensive. Now, the last time I looked them up was a few years ago, but I'm just talking about the cost of the drug now. I'm not talking about the doctor's time, the clinic, the insurance, the equipment, and all the rest of it. Was running over $1,000 per injection.
Whoa.
And the clinical studies are showing that after 2 years of doing this every 1, 2, 3 months, it's 50-50 whether it makes an improvement. An improvement, right? So in other words, it's not particularly stunning. It's expensive. You know, I don't think anybody wants to see something coming towards their eye, et cetera, et cetera. So wouldn't it be nice to find something that is more effective? Well, going back to Jonathan Wright, he found literature going way back about injecting minerals. But what I was wanting to focus on was a study that was published in 2005 in the New York Academy of Sciences, respected journal, that was conducted in China. There were 100 patients. There were 110 eyes because some patients had a problem in both of their eyes, right? And they were suffering from wet and dry. So, or I should have mentioned that many countries around the world, including my own, if I went along to my NHS hospital and they said, you've got dry macular degeneration, because of the cost and because of the paucity of effects, they will normally say, we're not going to treat you now, come back when it's wet. So in other words, when it's got really bad, we'll do something about it. So in this study in China, like I say, 100 patients, 110 eyes, some had dry, some had wet. I can't remember the exact breakdown of the numbers between the two at the moment. But what they gave everybody was very simple. They gave them every night 3 milligrams of melatonin, 50 milligrams of zinc, and if memory serves me correctly, 50 micrograms of selenium.
Is this oral?
Yeah. Yeah. It was actually all put into one pill. So they gave these folks that every night. Okay. Nothing else. Didn't do anything else. What they found was, and what they took were called fundus pictures, which is kind of pictures from the back of the eye. Within 3 months, there were already significant improvements in both wet and dry. And there are countless, in the article, you'll see countless before, during, after. Okay. They did it for 6 months. At the end of 6 months, 90% of the people no longer had wet or dry macular degeneration. The other 10% had made improvements, but perhaps hadn't eradicated it. What side effects were there? All dreadful side effects. People had better sleep, more energy, and felt less depressed. And we did a cost analysis on it at the time. Bear in mind, it's going back a while now, back to, what, around 2005, 2007, I think we were aware of this. And we were working out that if you'd have had standard treatment, the cost of the therapy would be running at sort of anywhere between $15,000, $25,000. Okay. And we worked out that the cost of this treatment, you know, making some allowances for the health professional's time to, you know, check on you and what have you, but you hardly need to be monitored. You know, you still go home. You know, could be running as much as $100 a year. And so I put that down as one of the wow factors.
Would you stick with that long term after the 6 months, or would you do it and then stop?
I see no reason not to. In fact, there is a strong argument for us older people, because if we start now talking about anti-aging, or shall we call it preventative medicine, I'm a strong advocate for melatonin, and I see no reason why. And I think there are many other minerals that people are deep in. Magnesium, for example, is a big problem. So yeah, good stuff. Selenium, good stuff.
Melatonin's not very, it's very misunderstood. There are some people who experience like a paradoxical melatonin effect where after like three or five hours, they wake up like wide awake, and it's like, it doesn't work the way it does for most people. Perhaps I wonder if like it would work as well for them. And I don't know if liposomal melatonin or extended release melatonin would work better for them.
You've hit the nail right on the head. This is where we get into what used to be called chronogeriatrics, which is the timing of things. And again, coming back to my favorite doctor, Jonathan Wright, he always says, if things are going wrong and we're not copying nature, we're either using the wrong molecule, the wrong dose, or the wrong timing. And of all the things today in the world of preventative anti-aging medicine, timing is probably the least well-known and the least well-addressed. One example, we are not fans of pellets, hormone pellets. If a man has a testosterone pellet inserted into his backside, this is so convenient, I only have to go in every 3 months and the doctor puts another one in and blah-de-blah. But imagine the release of that testosterone. We don't have AI nano-driven pellets. We might do one day, but we don't at the moment. So what you end up getting is this constant release of melatonin into your system. That's not natural. If you did a chart of time and the amount of testosterone in blood, time on this axis and testosterone, you'd see it be quite big in the morning, a big pulsate release, and maybe a few smaller pulsate releases as the day goes on. And if you do some exercise, it would have another one. But it's not doing that, right? So you've got to ask yourself, what does that do? What damage can occur? So coming back to melatonin, one of the great things that Walter and his team did was they looked at the natural pulsate release of melatonin. Now, melatonin is very unique because it's not in us in daylight, but it comes out in us when we go into darkness, which does mean if you go to the cinema at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, or you get on that flight and they pull down the shades and it's still 2 o'clock in the afternoon, but suddenly you feel tired. It's the reaction of melatonin, because what's it there for? It's there to tell the body it's nighttime, you should be sleeping. And the reason for that is it sends signal. Walter once described the pineal gland to me, which is the primary source of melatonin. He once said to me, consider it the conductor of the endocrine system. If you have a conductor of an orchestra, what happens? You make music. But if you have an orchestra without a conductor, what happens? It makes noise. So melatonin, by dissipating during daylight, is a signal to the hormones, and that's why most hormone, big hormone, are in the morning. Your growth hormone, your testosterone, because it's an impetus to get up and get on with the day, right? And that is a result of melatonin leaving the blood. There are many other aspects to melatonin. So if your circadian rhythms are correct, your day-night cycle, right? Once you've got that correct, your hormonal cyclicity will be correct. And when your hormonal cyclicity is correct, your immune system will be strong. So all these things go hand in glove. But what Walter and his team realized is the natural night peak of melatonin is between 1 a.m. and 3 a.m. That's probably why it's there the most important hours to be asleep, right? A lot of REM activity takes place at the same time, you know, rapid eye movement. So some of the melatonins on the market, they are time released, but how? Do you want a long, slow release that may still be with you at 6 a.m. in the morning? Or do you want the sublingual tablet, which is going to go and be out of you in half an hour? Neither may not be, unless you're going to get up at 1 o'clock in the morning and suck on that sublingual and then go back. You know, it's cost and convenience. Walter's MZS, what it did, or what it does, I should say, is he says you must take it between 9 o'clock and 11 o'clock at night. Okay. You do not have to go to bed. It is not necessary to go to bed. A lot of people say, but light entering the eye destroys melatonin. That's true. That's absolutely true. But it only destroys endogenously produced, in other words, naturally produced melatonin. If you've just thrown a tablet into your stomach, it will not stop that at all. Okay. So by taking MZS between 9 p.m. and 11 p.m., you are putting that melatonin into your blood between 1 a.m. and 3 a.m. So you're absolutely right. Timing can also be a very important factor.
Hmm. Okay. And then the other question I had about that is the decision to only include a couple minerals, zinc and selenium. What about copper to balance the zinc to copper ratio?
There are many other things you can get into, but on a simplistic level, I mean, Jonathan Wright used to give a multitude of different minerals by injection, I hasten to add, but he found that the patients who were already suffering with macular degeneration were in the bottom quartile. You know, if up here is absolutely premium optimal in terms of your mineral balance, most of us are operating in the middle. Yeah, suboptimal. But the folks who've got the problems, they're right down the bottom, right? So he found that in many cases, they needed that boost that could only be provided by injections in his particular case. But I think that's a big tick. If we can really successfully treat macular degeneration in a large percentage of people, I'm never going to say it's 100%. There's all sorts of complications, but imagine that. And really for very little money, it's a win-win, absolute win-win. If we stay in the visual field, there's another big one. And really weirdly, what we talked about was Italian and Chinese research. But this is going to be Russian research again. And it originated in the 90s and very early 2000s from a place called the Helmholtz Eye Institute in Moscow, who gave the world cataract surgery all those years ago. And they, back then, again, 90s, looked at the way the world is, you know, population is going, lots more older people, because cataract, or to be specific, senile cataract, is predominantly a problem of people in their 50s and up. Right? There are different kinds of cataract. You can get cataract by an accident in the eye, but senile cataract, the most prevalent one, is generally associated with age. They realized back in the 90s that with the world getting older, as we all know, although cataract surgery is very effective, and also is the safest form of surgery known, because you know how many cataract surgeries take place every day around the world. However, in 2% of cases, there are complications. And you don't want to be one of those 2%, do you? No. Okay. But surgery, you know, the very nature of it, it has an inherent risk, obviously. So, but the Russians said, okay, that aside, we're not going to have enough trained surgeons by, you know, 2050 or whatever to deal with the numbers of people. So they were given the job to go and find something that would help. And the bottom line was they found that another dipeptide, two amino acids, called carnosine, seems to be a natural protectant within the eye. Specifically, it is an anti-glycation agent. A lot of people think it's a antioxidant or a free radical scavenger. Maybe. But we think its predominant protective role is anti-glycation, which is to prevent protein, sugars, and oxygen from cross-linking, which impairs the proteins. So what happens, you imagine the lens is in the middle of your eye, and it's surrounded by this liquid, which is called the aqueous humor. So the light comes through the eye, hits the lens, and then the lens changes its shape by the muscles, a bit like a telescope, right? You change the lens to look in the distance. Well, happens in the eye, same thing. And then, of course, it puts the light onto the retina for you, and then from there to the brain. But with glycation, the crystallines within the lens, they become impaired, and they become clouded, and they can go from white to yellow to even brown. So the main product, the original product, was called CanSee, which obviously it's quite a good name, and it's two drops twice a day, and gets in there, and the human clinical studies, and there's been three to date, not huge, I admit, the biggest one was 48 people, but have shown that if used over 5 to 6 months, 89% of the people will improve their eyesight. And there have been cases where there have been a complete eradication of cataract. There's a bit more to CanSee, but I don't like to go down this road because I can't point you to any hard clinical evidence, but I can tell you about doctors who use it and have given statements to this effect, and of course patients. But it can lower intraocular pressure of the eye, not big time, but it can. And we think we know why. So what happens is these glycated proteins, they exist in other parts of the eye. There are two places of significance. One is called the Schlemm canal. And it's literally the valve that kind of puts things back into the bloodstream. The theory is that these glycated proteins can also block the Schlemm canal. Think of it as a clogged drain or a part clogged drain. So what? Who cares? Big deal. Well, that can lead to the pressure of the eye building up because the wastes are not being removed properly. Could be part of glaucoma. Imagine now we've seen patients who have reduced that pressure, and it's theorized that the action of carnosine in helping to break up and prevent glycated proteins from occurring in the first place will actually unclog the drain. More dramatically than that are people who suffer with dry eyes. Now, dry eyes is literally where the tears, because they're on, you know, we think, well, I'm not crying. What are you talking tears? They're happening all the time. The eye's putting a fluid on itself all the time. Otherwise, every time you blink, you go, ow, ow, ow. And that is, in extreme cases, what happens to people with very bad dry eyes. Well, you've got lacrimal ducts. We think the same thing's happening. They get blocked by these glycated proteins. So when they're reduced and removed, more fluid comes back on the eye. Now, there are two lubricants in CanSee in order to aid the comfort of the product, okay? And originally when I heard this many years ago, people coming back to me and saying, wow, it's really good for dry eyes, isn't it? And I go, well, yeah, it's got lubricants in, isn't it? I mean, there's 1,000 products on the market with lubricants in. And then they go, no, I don't use it anymore. What? no, I've used it for 6 months. I don't have dry eyes anymore. I don't use it anymore.
Yeah. And so the way CanSee works is it helps prevent glycation, which, to summarize, like when you spike your blood sugar, for example, you cause a lot of downstream issues, like the stickiness, so to speak, of the sugar. It wreaks havoc around the body and especially in the eyes. That's like one of the main sites that where it causes damage. And you can actually see this yourself. If you go out and you eat like a really sugary meal and you try and do something later that requires like very precise vision and sight, you can actually see your vision get worse an hour, 2 hours after like a high sugar meal compared to like earlier in the day when you haven't eaten.
Absolutely, Nick. And of course, it's a problem for diabetics because people, one of the measures is to see how many glycated proteins are in a person and say, oh, you're diabetic. I mean, you can measure the blood glucose as well, of course, but, you know, ABA1C and other factors, how many glycated proteins are circulating in that person. And as you rightly said, if you don't know you've got diabetes, you may go along to your doc when you start saying, my vision's blurry, right? Or my urine's sticky, or, there's 100 different ways of doing it. But absolutely right. People who eat a lot of sugar might suddenly find their eyesight's deteriorated.
But so if my vision was a little blurry for no particular reason, like I don't have cataracts, I don't have AMD, these wouldn't necessarily be my...
You didn't have 4 pints of beer.
Yeah, that too. none of that. But like, I guess it's age-related. Perhaps my vision's like slowly deteriorating, or say I already had glasses and like my prescription keeps getting worse and worse. These wouldn't necessarily be my things to look into, would they?
It's a good question. If it's genetic, perhaps not. I was told long ago that in most people, the average person, as we get older, the eyesight will actually lengthen and then come back the other way later on. That's why if you go into a hotel and you see the old folks reading the newspapers, they're all holding them out there, right? You would normally hold them here. They're all holding them out there, but they haven't got their glasses on to do the adjustment. I don't know. I think there'd be, it could. I'm not saying it wouldn't, but I'm not saying it would be my first choice.
All right. That's fairly comprehensive for the visual system. We got two different things to look into there. And then on the auditory side for hearing, I know there's another wow factor there.
Yeah, thanks, Nick. Again, this is one from my favorite doc, Dr. Jonathan Wright. That's Wright with a W, by the way, if anyone's looking him up. 1940s research, rediscovered by his university students. And what it was, there's a hormone called aldosterone, and it's produced in the adrenal glands. And the average, that's probably not the right word, the normal use for it is to help with salt balance in blood, and even sometimes it has a role in people's balance. When I look around different countries and I travel a reasonable bit, there are too many young people wearing glasses. It's got to be a nutritional thing, I think, amongst other things possibly, but there's something going on there that I think needs addressing. So I was going to say the high streets in our countries are full of shops that are selling glasses and hearing aids. It's treating a symptom. It's not getting to the cause. So what did Jonathan Wright and his team discover? Well, they discovered from 1940s research that patients who were having trouble hearing, who had no physical damage to their ear, were given aldosterone, regained their hearing. Now, one interesting side note to point out here, which has been covered by a guy called Dr. Rich Lipman, he thinks there are two hormones that are very predominant in hearing. One is aldosterone for the volume, and the other is IGF-1, or insulin-like growth factor, for the detail. Okay. But in most people's cases, I would suggest it's the volume that's the problem. So it turns out that when they gave, they've now since then developed a test whereby they can more or less say, if your aldosterone levels are here or lower, you will probably, and you have hearing loss, you will probably benefit by taking some aldosterone. Okay. Because of course, if your aldosterone levels are quite good, it may be something else. However, there is a large group of people who have taken aldosterone and got their hearing back. Now, two things to point out here. That when they gave these patients some aldosterone, they were giving them approximately 125 micrograms orally, that within a few days, their hearings returned to a near normal state. Now, did they have to keep taking aldosterone? Yeah. Yeah. Maybe not every day, but they were keeping these, monitoring the levels, keeping it up. Since then, and I'm happy to say I had a hand in this, there has been a liquid aldosterone made. It's called AldoPro, and it's in drops. Now, originally designed for sublingual use, until a bunch of docs say, what if it's eardrops? What happens is over several hours, the hearing is improved. Now you might say, well, what on earth's going on? How can you put it in your ear? Well, it turns out it's a signaling molecule. So the little hairs, which I've forgotten the name for, inside our inner ears are obviously vibrating with the air movements. That's what tells us. But it's the signal from those to the hearing center in the brain. And aldosterone appears to be part of that signaling.
Aldosterone has an impact here, and actually applying it works like a signaling molecule, and we get some of the benefits. Like, we actually notice like a pretty immediate effect, if we're going to notice one, when applied to the ear. So how would you recommend like going about addressing this deficiency, like the insufficient production? Like, are there things we can do so that we produce more aldosterone on our own?
The one thing I remember, because I some people hate this stuff, personally I love it, was licorice. He was saying there were 8 ingredients in licorice that were very good, but there were other things in that book. So there are obviously foodstuffs that will support our adrenal glands. So I would look to that. You know, coming back to the three, if you will, at the top of the pyramid, where I tend to spend most of my time, is I would look at melatonin as a general addresser, but don't go overnight with it. You allow 3 months before you make your mind up. I think it would be worth thinking about the adrenal peptide bioregulator. Although it's only popped in my head, I don't see why it shouldn't have an effect in that department. And of course, there is aldosterone itself.
What's cool about these, and specifically that last one, is that you can use the drops initially, figure out if that's what the issue is. You notice that relief or lack thereof pretty quickly, and then you can say, okay, I'm going to focus on naturally improving my aldosterone levels now, and then you don't need the drops eventually, and then you take care of it through peptides, bioregulators, lifestyle.
You'd only use it on odd occasions. You might say, oh, I really need to hear this, you know, or whatever. With one caveat there, Nick, and that is, make sure your ears are nice and clean first time you use it. This last one I'd like to tell you about, his name is Dr. Bill Cham. When he was a young man, he walked around his island and he noticed that horses and cows, etc., would sometimes rub themselves up against this local plant, which they call the devil's apple, but is actually a relation to eggplant. Okay. And he asked the farmers, because he was a budding biochemist training. And he asked the local farmers, why do the animals do this? And their reply was, well, they get lesions on their skin and they instinctively, when they get them, rub themselves up against this plant. And Bill said, weird. Does it help? And the farmers said, well, funny enough, yeah, it does. So this fascinated him. And he spent 20 years researching it, okay? And what he discovered an ingredient within this plant called psilocybin, okay? And what those lesions were, by the way, so I should point out, they're cancer, skin cancer we're talking about, they are what's known as squamous cell carcinomas and basal cell carcinomas. It's 100% effective in removing basal cell and squamous cell carcinomas. It's a cream, and you put it on twice a day.
And it 100%.
Takes 100%. If it was around the eye, inside the mouth, perhaps on the anus, somewhere it's possibly wet, it's not going to help you. But the majority of these kind, which are caused mainly by over sun exposure, right? You know, they can start as what's known as keratosis, which is called a sunspot. By the way, it gets rid of those in days. 80,000 patient cases documented. 80,000 patient cases documented. They know exactly how it works. What it does, it turns out that cancer cells, they coat themselves with the RIMOS coating that is not present on a healthy cell. It removes this RIMOS coating. The moment it removes that RIMOS coating, it would appear that the immune system says, ah, you're a non-self cell. And the natural process of apoptosis takes place. The cream is called Bec5 Curaderm, named after the inventor, Bill Edward Cham. That's why it's called Bec. Okay.
Well, Phil, this has been a blast. We've covered a lot of ground, a lot of different therapeutics. Again, last time we mentioned you coming on and talking about nootropics, but that will have to happen at a later date because we could easily talk for a lot longer about each of the different remedies and things that we were discussing today. But so far, if people want to connect with you, to follow your work, to subscribe to your magazine, which I've been loving, how can they get a hold of you?
Yeah, thanks, Nick. Yes, thank you. The magazine, we have published a lot, all these stories I've spoken about today, and folks can download them for free, or they can pay us $10 and have one delivered to their door, whatever you like. And that website is called aging-matters.com, aging-matters.com. That's all laid out there. And if you want even more detail on even more subjects, our main website, which has existed since 1996, if memory serves me right, or maybe a bit earlier, so it's accumulated a lot of pages, is antiaging-systems.com. So that will give you references, video links, all that sort of thing.
Absolutely. Phil, a couple more rapid-fire questions for you before we part ways today. First of all, what unusual substance or nootropic or vitamin or supplement or whatever have you used today or recently?
I'm not going to mention its name just at the moment, but I am just about to start experimenting with a supplement that increases stem cell activity. I'm pretty focused on the work of Bill Falloon, who's the owner of the Life Extension Foundation. And Bill is a terrific guy, and he has a couple of organizations other than Life Extension. He has the Age Reversal Network, which is well worth, if you want to really be serious, and this is going to be the lead story in our next magazine, he's got this idea, which he calls the stair-step approach to biological age control. And each step is a biochemical pathway. So we've got things like mTOR, autophagy, AMPK, senescence. You know, I'm sure some of these terms are familiar to your listeners. And then how do you address that? So I find that quite fascinating, that perhaps the most powerful thing we have, perhaps, for age control, it might be, it's got to be multifactorial. I think everyone would agree on that. Is what are you doing here? I mean, everyone knows about NAD at the moment, right? It's been a big thing because of David Sinclair. So you can ask yourself, here are seven steps. What am I doing here? 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 So that to me at the moment is very interesting.
I guess on another related note, if someone's interested in discovering some of these wow factors, obviously different wow factors, because you've now shared and spilled the beans on these ones. How, like, what's your system there? How did you go about finding these?
Well, really old-fashioned, if I'm perfectly honest with you. There's only a handful of us that actually do the R&D. It's mainly connections. You know, imagine after 30 years, I have got to know a lot of people. Not all of them are with us anymore, unfortunately. I always lose, you know, the old saying, standing on the shoulders of giants, is very true. So it's talking and knowing some really interesting people and meeting with them and sharing with them. That's a lot of it. And I read the books, a few behind me. I'm still a bit old fashioned like that. Of course, I watch videos online and, you know, people, as you network, they tend to send you things. But a lot of my interests are very esoteric.
Well, Phil, that's a good note to end on. Are there any other parting words or thoughts you'd like to leave listeners with today?
Oh gosh, you're testing me today, aren't you? yeah, be happy. And one thing I found as I got older is don't worry.
Well, Phil, it's been a pleasure hosting you again for round two today, and I am definitely looking forward to a follow-up show with you. But thanks for spending the time today and sharing these different breakthroughs with us.
You're welcome, Nick. Always a pleasure. Look forward to the next one.
Until next time, I'm Nick Urban here with Phil Mikins, signing out from mindbodypeak.com. Have a great week and be an outlier. Thank you for tuning in to this episode. Head over to Apple Music, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts and leave a rating. Every review helps me bring you thought-provoking guests. As always, you can find the show notes for this one at mindbodypeak.com/ and then the number of the episode. There, you can also chat with other peak performers or connect with me directly. The information depicted in this podcast is for information purposes only. Please consult your primary healthcare professional before making any lifestyle changes.